Matter of ST versus 1515 Broad Street LLC. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Charles Dawkins. May it please the court, Charles Dawkins appearing on behalf of Appellant ST. Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Peter A. Gaudioso, McElroy, Deutsch, Mulvaney, and Carpenter, Morristown, New Jersey, on behalf of the defendant respondent, Captain Glass.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Dawkins, please go ahead.
The issue before the court is when litigants, a counsel moves for the appointment of a guardian ad litem, what are the procedures and standards? And the court determining that a guardian ad litem, does it empower the guardian ad litem with the authority to make decisions on behalf of the litigant in the particular situation or the instant situation we're dealing with a settlement issue. The first point that we must consider is when the attorney or legal counsel moves for the appointment of a guardian ad litem. In the instant case, the attorney moved for the appointment of a guardian ad litem using a rule of professional conduct 1.14. And then the court, on its own motion, Rule 2B4, then determined that he would appoint or move for the appointment of a guardian ad litem. The issue, what applies to this aspect of the question is the Supreme Court precedent, In Re MR. In Re MR is very significant to the case and dispository because it sets down the precedent of what are the responsibilities of a counsel who's representing alleged incompetent and what are the responsibilities of a guardian ad litem. The decision is very clear that a counsel's position in representing alleged incompetent is to zealously represent the wishes of the alleged incompetent. MR is also very clear that the service of the guardian ad litem is to the court and that the guardian ad litem represents the best interests of the alleged incompetent after he does his evaluation and so forth. So when the attorney moves for the appointment of a guardian ad litem, according to MR, we have a direct conflict of interest. He cannot on one hand be an adversary for the incompetent and on the other hand move for the incompetent based on her best interests. If we look at the record, we will find that the attorney that was supposed to represent the wishes of counsel in the friendly hearing joined with defendants, joined with guardian ad litem in asserting that the case should be settled. Now, on that point alone, this court, this case is reversible because the trial court directly conflicted with In Re MR. The second point that we consider is the procedures and standards that the that must be used in appointing the guardian ad litem. Again, we look to precedent. Precedent is In Re SW. And I've mentioned in my certification for my petition that the lower court's ruling is in direct conflict with N. Ray S.W. N. Ray S.W., and since 1978, when we're looking to appoint a guardian ad litem, we look to constitutional procedural issues. And it mentions three. It mentions that when you're restraining the liberty of a person, when you're restraining the property of a person, and when you're restraining the property and the personal affairs of a person, then we must move forward in a constitutional framework. Now, at the time in 1978, the rule was 4:83. It has now moved to 4:86. 4:86 is very significant because 4:86, as the court stated in SW, is the only rule that will assure the constitutional protections of denying a person their ability or their desire to settle.
What does that do to Rule 4:26-2, appointment of guardian ad litem?
4:26-2 was appointment for a guardian ad litem.
Wasn't that what was appointed here, a guardian ad litem, not a guardian under 486?
Well, our position, Your Honor, is that 4:86 also permits a temporary guardian, also permits a pendant light guardian.
But under your interpretation of 486, you get 426-2, no power, no meaning. It goes
sorry
away.
Sorry to interrupt you.
No. So explain to me how you reconcile the two.
4:26 does have effect. 4:26, as it relates to N. Ray S.W., N. Ray S.W. states that a parent, that when there's an apparent incompetent, then we would use 4:26. In the ruling, it doesn't mention that, but apparent incompetency is very important because when you look at N. Ray M.R.,
isn't that what you have here, apparent incompetency, based only on the arguments of counsel that if they try the case, they may receive nothing at all, and it's in her best interest to take the settlement, which is not necessarily the issue. I'm not suggesting, but what we have here, does it fall under 426-2, apparent incompetency? There's no doctor, no certificate, nothing from a medical standpoint that indicates that this person is incompetent.
We would respectfully assert that apparent incompetency does not apply to S.W., when you look at the case law in Ray M.R., you're dealing with a person who is mildly retarded. When you're dealing with the case law as it relates to N. Ray Grady, you're dealing with a person with Down syndrome. When you look at the case law as it relates to N. Ray S.W., you're dealing with a person who is already committed.
No, you have to Mr. Dawkins, take a step back and tell us, and I hope your colleagues across the aisle can do the same. When a judge has an application for the appointment of a guardian ad litem, what standard should guide the judge? Should it be good cause, as the appellate division said? Should it be unfit and unable? Should it be something altogether different for the judge to assess before making an appointment to investigate? And then perhaps you can help us about the determination, the standard for the determination about empowering the guardian ad litem. What should the standard be for appointment of a guardian ad litem to investigate, and what's the source of authority that you point us to?
The standard would be the standard under Rule 4:86, and that's asserted under Rule 4:86A.
Why is that the right standard?
It's the right standard because based upon case law interpretation of the rules, it's the best rule to apply. And our understanding of case law is that N. Ray S.W. Establishes that we're dealing with the deprivation of constitutional rights.
Can't you harmonize 426-2 with 486? So let's look at the rules. 426-2A, I'm not going to read the whole thing, says a minor or mentally incapacitated person shall be represented in action by the guardian, right?
Yes.
I've read that. So then if you look down to B, B4, appointment on court's motion. The court may appoint a guardian in ad litem for a minor or alleged mentally incapacitated person on its own motion. Now that's alleged. Now before the court can take any action, the person has to be determined to be mentally incapacitated, and that's where 4:86 comes into play, according to your argument. The court and the parties have to go through 4:86, which sets forth the constitutional standard for the appointment of a guardian. 4:26.2.4 merely is appointing an attorney as a guardian for going through the process in 4:86-1. Someone has to investigate whether or not the person is mentally incapacitated, has to have conversations with the doctors, get the information, and put it all together and provide it to the court. But the actual determination as to whether someone's mentally incapacitated is defined in 4:86.1. Am I making any sense?
Yes, it's very logical, Your Honor. And that's an analysis that could be used. The lower court did not use that analysis. It used the good cause analysis.
Going back to 4, it's talking about alleged mental incapacity. Even 4:86 talks about that, because there has to be an ultimate determination that the person is mentally incapacitated before someone can be named as a guardian over their person or property.
Yes.
To act on their behalf.
Yes, that's exactly.
You can't be acting on their behalf if it's merely an allegation.
Yes, that's exactly our understanding of the ruling as it relates to SW. And the problem with the ruling court is that comment 3 on rule 4:62 is very explicit. It states that the guardian, that the court can appoint a guardian ad litem to investigate the case and to make a recommendation as to whether a formal hearing should be heard.
Which is what happens under a typical 4:86. The judge, a chancery court judge, assigns an attorney to investigate the matter and to collect all of the documents and to make a recommendation to the court, but in an adversarial setting.
Exactly.
So what's the threshold for the judge who has heard there's an allegation of incompetency to appoint a guardian ad litem to investigate?
Well, the threshold, there is no argument as to the rule for professional conduct being used as for the judge to consider the investigation.
So a reasonable belief.
It's a reasonable belief, yes. The judge has a great deal of discretion. It's just that what happens after the recommendation, should the good cause standard be used, we aggressively deny the good cause standard, and for one, because of what the appellate court said. The appellate court stated that there is no case law that substantiates the good cause. It looked to Supreme Court precedent in MR to come up with its good cause standard.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes,
was there
Your Honor.
Any determination by the court in this case that ST was mentally incapacitated?
No. Yes. Well, none that the record which I have reviewed, I want to be specific about my statement. The record that I have reviewed, I've seen only the reports by Dr. Crane and another physician.
I'm talking about a judicial finding. Did the court in this case ever determine that ST was mentally incapacitated to make decisions about the course of this case and whether to settle. And I'm using the term mentally incapacitated.
In my review of the record, I have not seen any statements, any basis that specifically asserts that ST is mentally incapacitated. That would actually...
So the judge found there was, quote, good cause
good
for the
cause.
Guardian ad litem to remain. Did the judge explain what went into that finding?
Well, what
went... Justice Alvin's question. Go ahead.
Yes, Your Honor. Excuse me for interrupting. What I understand what the judge did is he had conferences, number one, which we disagree with her attorney, who made the recommendation that she is incompetent. He reviewed the logic of the case, meaning that, you know, is it logical for a settlement? What's the evidence and so forth? And no one is privy to that information because, of course, defense counsel cannot know.
But one of the problems with that statement that was submitted to the judge through the written report of Mr. Maselli is that it seemed as if he put the burden on ST to prove to him that she was competent and capable to make decisions that essentially he agreed with, because that was apparently his standard for best interest.
Your Honor, in my brief, I did not brief that issue, but since you have mentioned it, my understanding is that that's in conflict with MR, because the situation in MR is that, hey, they were trying to prove that MR was incompetent, and that was the mother's burden. That's not the father's burden.
Right.
And so
it's plain in the wording of the transcript and reports that was a standard that was being presented by the investigating attorney when he was making his recommendation to the court.
Yes, that was his recommendation.
You don't agree with that, do you?
Oh, no, absolutely not. Our argument, as we started, we really start having problems when she's not given attorney.
If that's the standard, how can there even be a sufficient showing on this record for the court to make the kind of finding that the Chief and Justice Albin are asking you whether or not the court, in fact, made, that ST is incompetent to manage her affairs in this litigation?
That's the issue. And our argument is that there is not enough evidence to assert that she's incompetent. In fact...
Well, it's a term mental... I'm trying to now want to know what the terminology is. Is it mental incapacity or incompetence?
The state... The rules of 486, my understanding, is mental incapacitation.
So that has to be termination. Was
are we sure? Just be sure. 486.1A refers to determination of incapacity of the person. Is that not the standard?
Yes.
Every action for the determination of incapacity of a person. And, of course, that includes limited.
Yes.
The need for a limited or temporary guardian. So it could be a limited incapacity, correct?
Yes, absolutely. And that is a problem which I mentioned, which we mentioned on our brief, with the lower court's ruling. For some reason, the lower court uses the word general guardian ad litem, and based upon this being a 486 being a general guardian ad litem, it's just too expansive for these type of issues. And the court didn't consider the flexibility of 4:86. Moreover, the court didn't consider that the language really says every. You know, and it's very specific. And our position is it says every. And
was your client advised of her right to counsel at this a separate counsel representing her interests at this friendly hearing?
Absolutely not. And I have actually read that friendly hearing very closely. And she was not, and I'm frankly shocked that she was actually representing herself.
She was acting basically pro se.
Pro se without knowing it.
She was never given notice that she had a right to separate counsel to contest the positions that the guardian was taking and her own attorney was taking from her perspective against her interests?
No. And I mentioned that in my brief. And in fact, I mentioned in my brief that the lower court mentions that she didn't get any notice. Actually, if the lower court did not mention she didn't get any notice, I may have overlooked it. But it knows that. And Carcass, you know, you can go back to 1925, 1930. You know, that's and the basis of New Jersey law. You have in these type of situations, when you're dealing with denying or depriving a person of a settlement, and let's be clear, they say, well, you know, it's just a settlement, it's only money.
She well, actually, said, this is the other way around. Everyone there wanted the settlement except your client, and she was not represented by anyone to put forth her position in any legal form by someone with legal knowledge. No. Everyone else at that friendly, except the judge who was neutral, was going to decide it, wanted to threaten the settlement to go through. She was the only one that did not wish it to go through, and she had no representation.
She had absolutely. My argument is that she had no representation. The defense counsel's actually has been here from the beginning to the end. So they, you know, they have probably more of an insight as to what went on. But based upon the record, I haven't seen any legal counsel. In fact, we were given notice to her legal counsel until I stopped after I did the research. He was getting notice as if he's still her lawyer. And there was arguments made by the former appellate lawyer that he had the ability to settle the matter, and he really was the lawyer. So they still was considering him as a lawyer right up until the point I stopped sending him notice, and that's at the Supreme Court level.
What relief are you seeking?
What relief are we seeking? First, according to 484-486-4, she's able to get appointed legal counsel.
Now, are you looking for a trial? This is what I'm
looking for.
Yeah, I mean, if you were to succeed before the court, do you want to give expression to your client's wishes? She wanted a trial. Does she want to undo the settlement and proceed to a trial?
Absolutely, she wants to undo the settlement. There is statements she considers the offer 30 cents on a dollar. So, you know, if they can make the offer worth her while, of course, we would, or she would consider. But based on what's on the table and what remained on the table, based upon how the negotiators started, the lowness of the negotiation, I see a trial ahead.
Has the settlement money already been dispersed?
Absolutely not. She doesn't want it. She's fighting that tooth and nail.
And are your ST's counsel now and will be if there is a trial?
I'm ST's counsel as of now. I will discuss with her how we will proceed, whether she wants to retain me for the lower court or not. I'll give her that option. But as of now, for the Supreme Court, I am definitely her counsel.
I want to clarify one thing about the settlement monies and what has happened. We have the number, the 625 number, ultimately. Was any of that dispersed to anyone? I'm not asking if your client spent it. I'm asking whether any of the monies were paid out.
My understanding, and I won't deal with personal knowledge or talk with my client, but my understanding, based upon the record, based upon everything that I've seen, no money has been dispersed.
Okay. If we end up reversing the trial court and the appellate division's judgment, and it goes back, wouldn't you still go through the process that you enumerated if there's an allegation of incompetence? Wouldn't you still have to go through that process to show, and do you show general incompetence? Do you show specific incompetence to handle this settlement? In other words, wouldn't you still have to go back, if it's pursued, through the process of a hearing with due process to determine competence to make this judgment, and then go from there? You don't, rather than simply remanding for a trial on the merits.
Yes, that's actually the approach that we would
So
prefer.
The first step would be an allegation. The next step would be a determination as to whether that allegation warrants a hearing. And the next step would be a hearing in accordance with the due process requirements of notice, opportunity to be heard, and representation.
There is an issue, however, that I may ask, is that when she retains new counsel, it's highly probable new counsel is not going to make the allegation of incompetence.
Well, oh, no, I'm not suggesting that.
Or mental incapacitation.
It's not going to happen. So
so what Justice Solomon is saying, I think, the first step may be, depending upon who's making allegations, is that you may have to go through a 486 hearing. If someone has made a good faith allegation that your client doesn't have the mental capacity to decide the course of her own case.
And yes, Your Honor, and that's really important, because part of the problem with the 4:26-2 good cause is that there isn't any record. Now, if we have a hearing and she's represented by counsel, and counsel's able to cross-examine these people, and counsel's able to put her on as a witness, and 486 provides that if she wants to challenge what the other attorney did, she can ask the trial by jury before the order, even before we even have the hearing. 486 it makes it onerous for somebody just to make an allegation that you're incompetent, and they're going to have a hard time.
Is your client taking care of her own affairs, business affairs, financial affairs, and all sorts of other affairs currently?
Yes, Your Honor, and I've been talking with her for probably close to a year now. She's not only taking care of her affairs, she's taking care of her mother's affairs.
When all that come out during the 486 hearing?
Yes.
And that would trial court make the determination after assessing credibility of the witnesses, observing the demeanor, behavior, their willingness to answer questions, determine whether there is incompetence or not, and then we move forward from there?
Yes. And may I ask, add one more thing that I found very troubling about this case, is that nowhere within there here do I see a deposition. If a person can take a deposition and they seem intelligent, cogent, understanding, how can they not make a decision? Now, the problem is the deposition. The problem is, can she take the stand? And there's nothing mentioned within anywhere, a deposition. Now, if we had the deposition and we saw she couldn't answer things and she couldn't process, because that's what they're asserting.
They're not asserting, from what I can see from reading the friendly hearing, they're not asserting that she's incapable of doing anything other than determining whether to settle her own case.
Yep.
They're fine with every, I'm looking at page 8, where the court says, we're not in any way saying that she is incompetent to handle her affairs, but just a limited, diminished capacity with regard to decision-making when it came to decide whether or not this was a good case to settle. So they're saying that, she's great in every aspect of her life, she can decide everything. The only thing that she can't determine is whether to settle her own case.
Yes, I stand corrected on that. Yeah.
So clarify for us what you believe the standard at the end of the hearing. You want a hearing with notice and an opportunity to be heard, as you've articulated. And then what must the finding at the end be for a judge to empower a guardian ad litem?
After you have a standing, after you have a hearing, notice, witnesses and so forth, a record, a counsel that's represented her in the adversarial state, the judge has the discretion then to make a decision, an evidential decision, to empower the guardian ad litem.
Yes, but I'm asking you for what the specific standard should be to guide that determination, because if we look at and Justice Alvin's question was just pointing to it, 486-2 speaks about whether the individual is unfit and unable to govern himself or herself and to manage his or her affairs. Is that the standard, or is it a more limited finding, whether the person is unfit and unable to make a determination in the context of this litigation? What's the right standard?
My argument would be the standard is the plain letter wording of Rule 4:86, which you articulated. There's been a lot of other assertions of other standards, but the rule governs.
What about 86-2BG, where the court rule is getting into, and also F, where the court's considering the evidence through the client's opinions, but basically it's the evidence that's produced in these proceedings. To the extent a person is unfit and unable to govern herself and to manage his or her own affairs, reviewed with particularity, and then G, if applicable, the extent to which the person retains sufficient capacity to retain the right to manage specific areas. So don't those two sides need to be reconciled in the court's analysis of the evidence that's produced when deciding whether or not to appoint a limited guardian for the purposes of assisting the person with the handling of litigation as we're dealing with here?
Yes.
Okay, and in MR, when Justice Pollack was talking about how the court balances the judicial responsibility to preserve self-determination and still fulfill the judicial function to ensure that the best interest of the person is maintained, at about page 167, where he's grappling with that for the court, there is, I think, the clear message from MR that once the court determines that the person is unfit and can't express the preference because of their incapacity difficulties, the court still has an obligation in assessing best interests to try to discern and implement what the person would have done in her best interest and to the extent one could discern that preference had the person been fit. Do you agree with that? Is that the standard that needs to be applied when we're dealing with a situation? I've never heard of a situation like this where a person is proceeding with their own litigation and because a settlement offer that attorneys perceive to be a good one and in the person's best interest is not the one that the litigant wants to pursue. And that difference of opinion has got us to this point where a court has actually considered whether or not to take that decision away from the litigant. I think it fits within the context of MR, but I think there still has to be some analysis, help me if you disagree with this, of what the person's preference would have been, even applying a best interest when someone's got that limited incapacity.
Well, in Re MR, and it cites in Re O'Grady,
right,
which are very, very unique cases.
Well, this is not a Grady situation.
Okay, I won't go there then. I won't mention, but the situation is that in Re MR is mildly retarded. We're trying to figure out which parent she's going to live with. And I'm not saying a presumption, but the court looks at, when you look at N. Re. S.W., N. Re. M.R., they look at the position and where the person's at to some idea to grapple with whether or not they're going to lean more toward a best interest standard or be more concerned with whether the person's able to make up their own decision.
Well, Counselor, let me follow up on Justice Rebecca's question a little bit more from a practical standpoint. We've been talking about the standard, what the standard should be. Whether someone is making a bad decision, whether to settle a case or not, does that play a part in that standard, or is it simply whether people are entitled to make a bad decision if they choose? Is that going to be part of the hearing, or is that out of bounds? Because as I understand this case, this is a personal injury case.
Yes, it is.
Plaintiffs are entitled to, required to prove their injury within a reasonably grammatical probability.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is that the MRIs don't support, and that some of them, if not all the treating physicians, will not testify. Regardless of that, because some people might say that it's not a good choice to reject the settlement. Is that part of the court's analysis, or is that simply out of bounds? And the question is whether your client understands the parameters, and if she chooses to make a bad choice, that's her decision and her choice, and it doesn't fall within the incapacity.
Our position is out of bounds. It's out of bounds because it doesn't really deal with incapacity. I have some people.
I just wanted to get it from the practical standpoint, not the standard.
People are permitted to make dumb choices,
provided
that they have the appropriate mental capacity under 486 and are able to govern their own affairs.
Yes, and in defense of ST, ST's position is that she's basically in the same position as MR, and that her lawyer wasn't aggressively arguing her position.
You can argue you're in a better position because MR was developmentally disabled, and according to the court, she had the intellectual level of a 6 to an 8 year old, and still the court there was concerned about allowing her the right of self-determination, of at least some form of self-determination.
Yes.
And your case, no one is claiming the sort of disabilities that were afflicting MR.
I agree absolutely with
that. So going back to the MR situation, since whatever we do is going to apply to cases beyond your case, as an MR, even where the individual is incompetent generally or incapacitated generally, that doesn't mean that they are incompetent to make the specific decision that is being made here. And I guess that comes back to what the Chief said and what Justice Fernandez-Vina said. That's a separate question. And maybe it was Justice Alvin, does the court have to discern what is the decision this person, a competent person, would have made, or simply whether this person is competent to make the decision, this specific decision, whether generally incompetent or not? And if competent, it can be a bad decision. It's still her right to make the decision. Did I say that confusingly enough?
I agreed with everything you stated, Your Honor, in terms of our arguments. She is, and the issue is whether she's incapacitated to the extent that she can logically make a decision. Whether this decision is in her best interest or not, that's not an issue. And I believe there is case law that asserts that clients are always making bad decisions.
And you're basically position, she's capable of managing every other decision in her life, that she certainly is capable of making the decision, whether it's good or bad, in determining whether to settle a case.
Absolutely. With notice and a hearing, our position would be that she's not incapacitated.
I'm sorry. Please finish your answer.
Our argument would be she's not incapacitated. She can do everything that everybody else has. In fact, she can teach calculus. Now, they may, and organic chemistry. Now, they may say, well, you know, she can do this, but she's not logically able to do this. But the situation is that our argument is similar to MR. And we do not understand why the motion was made, where RPC 1.14 was made anyway. And that would be the position that we would be taking if we're going forward. And with a notice and an opportunity to be heard, as well as Rule 4:86, which mentions that she can even challenge what the RPC 1.14 and ask a trial by jury. It's very, when you're talking about denying a person of significant rights, it's difficult to do.
I think we have your position. Thank you, Mr. Dawkins.
And thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Godioso.
Chief Justice Ravner, Honorable Justices, may it please the Court. The protocol that the Appellate Division established to appoint a guardian ad litem in the context of a litigated case and to make decisions therein satisfied the requirements here of due process and produced a result that ultimately was fair, reasonable, and in the plaintiff's best interests. Indeed, a remand here to a trial would expose the plaintiff to a significant risk of financial ruin, not just harm, but ruin. Alternatively, a remand for a guardianship proceeding under Rule 486 would lead us right back to where we are right now. To pick up on questions from Justice Albin and Justice Fernandez-Vita, the trial court's use of Rule 426(2) for the initial appointment of the guardian ad litem was appropriate. It was in the context of a litigated matter before the court. The plaintiff's counsel had grave concern about his client's ability to withstand the rigors of a four-week trial, and certainly while it's not a matter of record, there is an attorney in the case who couldn't tell that from every interaction that we had with the plaintiff. Accordingly, under Rule Professional Conduct 1.14b, he discharged his ethical duty to the court, an affirmative duty to the court, to his client, to have a guardian ad litem appointed in that situation. Second, the rubric that the Appellate Division developed to establish the initial appointment of the guardian ad litem under good cause is the appropriate standard to use. Now, the rule, of course, in subsection A talks about good cause, and we all know that good cause is not something that is readily defined very easily. But, of course, the case law in our state says a good cause is kind of an amorphous concept, resides in the sound discretion of the trial court in light of all the facts and circumstances of a case, and in the context and the purpose of the rule under which the good cause standard is being applied. And as the Appellate Division found correctly, we believe, in this case, when you're dealing with somebody who is alleged to be incompetent, the good cause standard should be a low bar. Because in this sense, the court is receiving a referral from an attorney who's an attorney for the client, who, by the way, had fought this case tooth and nail up to that point. We were 4 weeks away from trial when this occurred. Fought this case tooth and nail all the way to that point. It can't but help trigger in the court the need and a desire to ensure that before this case goes to trial, before this person rejects a substantial amount of money, that she is able to process the information. So that the investigatory standard should be low. The idea that you'd have to prove lunacy, or it's one of the 70-year-old cases, or that a person's not fit for government of self or property just to have an inquiry done, seems to be inconsistent with that notion. So third, the rubric that the Appellate Division adopted in ultimately empowering the guardian ad litem to infringe upon the rights of the alleged incompetent to accept or reject the settlement, the use of the clear and convincing evidence standard, I believe is correct. We believe is correct. I'm not so sure that the plaintiff doesn't believe it's correct. Certainly it's the standard that the court enunciated in MR in slightly different context, of course, to talk about what has to happen, what has to be proven, to what burden of proof, and who carries that burden of proof for purposes of establishing that the decision-making rights should be somewhat impaired. So that takes us down to the nub of the action here, is whether the procedural safeguards of Rule 486 were required here. And we say they were not required here, number one, and number two, there was due process here for ST. We refer, Your Honors, to the case of Julius versus Julius, which is an Appellate Division decision, 320 New Jersey Super, cited in our briefs, cited in the lower Appellate Division decision, where a guardian ad litem was appointed under Rule 426(2), just as the same way this one was, by motion from counsel, and certification from a psychiatrist. Over time, that guardian ad litem engaged in decisions that more or less impaired or restricted or did the things that the alleged incompetent would have done. Was never found to be incompetent, by the way, in that case. And the appellate division ultimately met that with approbation, because in that circumstance, the court, meaning the law division court, the trial court, had intertwined, had constant supervision over what was going on down below. And in that case, I believe there was the guardian ad litem managed the business or appointed someone to manage the business. There were restraints entered. Probably, in some respects, as restrictive, or if not more restrictive, than the types of restraints or impingement on personal liberty that occurred here. But in the context of this case, where Rule 426.2 was applied, we can all talk about authorizing the guardian ad litem under a point under Rule 426.2 to appoint or to authorize the guardian ad litem to do to try this or to resolve this case. I think the terms were by trial or by settlement. That's fair enough. And I cannot contest and will not contest that there was no other hearing. There was prior to the entry of that April 2014 order that authorized, quote-unquote, authorized the guardian ad litem to act in that way. But the fact of the matter is, Your Honor, the guardian ad litem is not authorized to do anything other than assist the plaintiff in that case at that time.
Against her will. I want to go through some of the steps. Go ahead.
Sure.
You want to follow?
No. I guess my point is, Justice Alban, I'll finish it. I'm, of course, happy to answer your question. The point is that all that could happen was there would be either a trial or a settlement, and the guardian ad litem could not sign on a dotted line and all of a sudden there's a settlement. It still had to go through a friendly hearing, which in this case lasted an hour. I know Your Honors have the transcript of the friendly hearing, I'm sure you've read it. And again, I have to concede there was no separate counsel appointed there. Fair enough. Ms. Tran certainly did make her wishes known.
But the only thing the friendly hearing considered was whether it was a fair offer, not whether the plaintiff wished to take the offer, and obviously she was competent to reject it. People are entitled to, I've tried a case or two as a defense attorney.
I've heard, Your Honor.
Sometimes you make offers, people reject them. Sometimes they win, sometimes you know cause it. But the fact that they reject what I think is a fair offer doesn't mean that they're incompetent. Doesn't mean that somebody should be appointed, does it? Because that's all the friendly hearing considered was whether the offer was fair and reasonable. And
I do agree with that in the general concept, Your Honor. And it's certainly in an ordinary friendly hearing that usually lasts about 10 minutes after the lawyers get together, and there's the usual, you put your hand on the Bible and the witness gives testimony, and we're done. This friendly hearing lasted for a better part of an hour, if not more.
But there was no determination of mental incapacity. I want to ask you about due process, because that's what you focused on.
Yes, sir.
So no one necessarily has to say that the attorney did not fulfill his responsibility under the RPC. He thought that it was diminished capacity. Then you go to the judge, and you think that there's an alleged mental incapacity. And the judge now appoints the guardian ad litem under good cause. But there has yet to be, that's just setting in motion what should have been a hearing where the judge should have been making a determination as to whether or not there in fact was mental incapacity, with ST having the right to have an attorney, and with fact findings and maybe testimony by doctors. Certainly affidavits under 486. That is what is absent here, is the due process before there was a determination that someone was going to take over the wheel for ST and start making decisions that ordinarily she would make. So what do you have to say about that?
I'll try to break that down into its constituent parts, Your Honor. And it was not a question that was unanticipated. I'm hopeful that the answer I have is worthy of the question. In respect of the, and if I understand Justice Albin, your question correctly. Your focus is on the 4/22/2014 order where the trial judge entered an order at that point authorizing the guardian ad litem to act. Did I understand that correctly?
I think he could act. I think he certainly could act as an investigator and bring documents together, maybe even make a recommendation to the court. But the court under 486, and I think this would be required under due process, then was required to make his own factual findings as to whether or not she was mentally incapacitated to govern her own affairs, even if it was merely for this one thing. And under due process, ST should have been given notice so that she would have the right to have an attorney to represent her. And I don't. That's what's absent from the record.
That is absent from the record, Your Honor, but I'm not sure that makes a difference here. Because at the end of the day, just as in Julius versus Julius, Judge Carey oversaw the not just the settlement conference, not that he participated in it, mind you, he did not, but certainly Sabrina ST's counsel was there, the guardian ad litem was there, all the defense counsel were there, and he managed to inveigle even more money
but
out of
the defense. But that's not the point.
Put aside the outcome
in this particular
case that you're advancing. And talk to us about the principles that should apply here and in future cases. And let's start at the beginning.
Yes.
Lawyer comes forward and says, Judge, I have a reasonable belief of my client's diminished capacity. Appoint someone to investigate that. What's the standard for the judge to decide whether to go forward? Is it reasonable belief? Is it good cause? Is it something else?
First, Your Honor, I...
Are they different?
First, Your Honor, I would say that it was good cause. Simply because the cop-out to that is because it's specifically in Rule 426.2, the term good cause is used.
Except that applies to a situation where, in A, we are already speaking about someone who is a minor or mentally incapacitated person. It's not about investigating the allegation.
That's fair enough, Your Honor, and I recognize the distinction. But on that score, again, not to repeat what I said earlier, but I believe and we believe that the appellate division was correct on that score. The notion that a high burden should be required to merely conduct an inquiry is anathema to the whole purpose of the inquiry. You shouldn't have to show, if I may, and again, not to quote the appellate division, I don't think I could do it verbatim, but you shouldn't have to show that somebody is a lunatic or unfit for government of self or of property to investigate whether the person lacks the capacity
right.
to understand what's going on around him or her.
So this is the easier part. Your colleague says it should be the reasonable belief standard. You say good cause. Is there much daylight between the two in any event?
Not in the way that I am understanding or using the term, Your Honor.
Okay.
Given how good cause has been defined by our courts for decades.
Then someone is appointed conduct an investigation and report back to the court. What steps should occur before the judge were to enter a finding?
Well, of course, there would be a fact-finding. The guardian ad litem would perform an investigation, as the guardian ad litem did here, which was a very thorough investigation, resulted in a report to the judge.
On notice?
It was not done on notice here.
Should it be? We're talking about the principal rules you think should be in an opinion of this court.
It depends on the circumstance, Your Honor. In this case, it was a litigated matter before the court where the appointment was made under Rule 426-2, not Rule 4:86. And Ms. Tran at that point did have trial counsel. I shouldn't start out that way. An attorney is not obliged to take up a position or take up the cudgel on an argument that the attorney believes is going to be financially ruinous or is patently absurd or is not in his client's best interest. There's no obligation to do that. Even if there had been a hearing in this circumstance or in any other circumstance, there's no guarantee that the lawyer is going to, who's appointed as, for lack of a better word, I don't mean to use a redundant term, advocate counsel, is going to have the basis or the belief that it should be done.
I don't understand. Yeah, I know you're responding. I don't understand the point you're making, because in this case, the attorney is now taking a position in direct conflict with his client's wishes and is now starting the machinery in motion in our judicial system to take away her right of self-determination. So the question that the chief was asking, like, while you're doing this, while you're getting this machinery in motion to strip her of her right to decide her own affairs, should you give her notice so that she can get her own attorney to represent her so that she's not left pro se as she was in the friendly hearing?
I apologize, Chief Justice Radner. Mr. Justice Albin's question resonated with me a little bit more than yours did. I apologize. In ideally, Justice Albin, yes. Ideally, yes. Looking at the facts of this case, was it required or would it have made a difference here? The answer we still maintain the position is no, just as it did not in Julius versus Julius.
How can you make that statement when there's never been a finding by a court that this was a minor or an incompetent person, or that, frankly, that there really was a conflict, that she was capable of voicing her interest, which was different than what her attorney was advocating for, and nobody even consider whether she's competent to make that assertion, and there's a conflict, which the rule contemplates, 426.2, we better appoint somebody else to take her stance and argue this position. Not even that finding was made. How can you make the argument you're making?
Well, because, again, under Rule 420, when the appointment is made under Rule 426.2, it's all done under the supervision of the court.
So what? So. 426.2 anticipates that a conflict may exist, and that person I just appointed can't be the guardian in this matter. If the court had said, based on the evidence, a hearing, an opportunity, that she's incompetent, generally incompetent, they could have then appointed somebody, gone through the process, and maybe you're right, maybe the outcome was the right outcome. But none of that ever happened here.
No, it did not, Your Honor. And when the question is asked that way and viewed from that perspective, I don't know that they are reconcilable. I don't know that they are reconciled.
So come back to the timeline. The individual now has notice what this proceeding is all about. A hearing is conducted. Fulsome presentation by both sides is made. What is the standard by which a judge is to make a determination?
The standard by which a judge is to make a determination would be by clear and convincing evidence.
Of
that the evidence shown to the judge presiding over the proceedings that the person is incapacitated, thank you. I didn't mean to point, Justice Albin.
No, it's okay.
That the person is incapacitated for the purpose of making the decision at hand.
Which is going to be a very difficult thing, I would say, and to make a finding. I'm not saying it couldn't happen, that a person is able to govern her affairs in every respect, make every banking decision, decide what stocks to invest, make every decision conceivable about her life. But the one thing that is at issue here, whether or not she should proceed with the trial after giving her attorney $30,000 for expenses, whatever. So that's the one thing that the court would have to find. That would seem to me like a pretty extraordinary finding.
Well, Justice Albin, counsel was right about, and I know we can agree on, I have been in the case from the beginning. And while I would concede that ST is capable of functioning, there's a difference between what the court is, what you're suggesting, Justice, and what this type of decision being made has that you have to be able to acknowledge and consider. And certainly, you know, rule subsection F of the rule, as Justice Slovecki pointed out, is a broader is broader when it talks about the scope of the guardianship that would be appointed under Rule 4A6. Subsection F is more narrow, and even and the rule does contemplate 4A6, a general guardian, a limited guardian, and so forth. So while even if that were the case, Your Honor, where it would be exceedingly difficult or unlikely, it certainly shouldn't be ruled out.
No, I don't think anyone would suggest that it should be.
Right.
I mean, look, actually, the court couldn't say that the settlement wasn't fair. That's not the issue. But the question is, in any personal injury case, there is like a wide, from Cuevas, there is a wide span. She could lose the case. She could get less. She could get that amount. Or she could have gotten millions. No one can predict what a jury would do. There's no scientific precision, not with the type of injuries that she has alleged. Do you agree?
I don't disagree with that, Your Honor, and I certainly don't disagree with your comment and Justice Fernandez-Vina's comment that, for lack of being more eloquent, you have a constitutional right to make a lousy decision.
You would think the plaintiff's attorney would actually want that, because now you have on the record his recommendation, so that if the case goes sour, as it well might, there's some protection from the plaintiff's subsequent cause of action against the attorney. So you would think you would want the standard that, by the way, I never read Quaver because I don't like the guy who wrote it. But you would think that you would want that for the standard that Justice Alvin suggests for that very reason.
I would think so, Your Honor, if I was the plaintiff's lawyer. However, and this goes back to a question that an issue that Justice Slovecki raised earlier, I think it was you, Justice Slovecki, is that while certainly everyone has a right to make a bad decision, if the process by which that decision is made, the person making the decision does not and is not capable of fully understanding the risks, then that's not a valid bad decision. And that's certainly what we believe that Judge Carey in the law division ultimately determined.
But you're suggesting a competent person who can evaluate the risks and says, I'm ending up with nothing, I'm toast either way, I'm rolling the dice. By the way, I went to the casino the other day, I rolled the dice, I lost there too. I didn't actually, I'm just saying, as an example.
Yeah, and Justice Solomon, this is that's a question with which we wrestled, because you know, there's always in the back of your mind, well, at any time a plaintiff's lawyer or a defense lawyer gets themselves into a position where, boy, I'd just like to get this case over with, that the courts are now flooded with Rule 426(2) applications.
I mean, it's worse. It's actually.
I'm not suggesting that.
But that could happen. I mean, if we simply say in this case, with the record we have, that this plaintiff was found to be not capable of making this decision under this record without a notice, an opportunity to be heard, a recognition of the potential conflict, the appointment of a guardian for this specific determination, don't we create that risk going forward? Forget that you may turn out to be absolutely right in the end. You may absolutely every position, every argument, but we're worried about every case like this. Right?
That I understand, Your Honor. I'm given to trust the sound discretion of the law division judges who sift through thousands of these cases every year. This law division judge who did this case is certainly not only no different from those judges, he was one of the best before he retired. And on this record, given everything that all of the attorneys in this case knew about the plaintiff in this case, the procedures followed here in this case, and I understand your question goes beyond that, were led to the right result. If you're asking me how do we get beyond that ensure that that doesn't occur in the future in a way that could be abused. If the court is going to take adverse, if the court is going to reverse here or remand, I would think that the outcome here would likely be a remandment to a 486 proceeding, which perhaps the court would consider amending the rules or amending Rule 426-2, or perhaps Justice Venerio, Chief Justice Venerio, will write an additional commentary based on the
argument.
It
may be that 426-2 isn't clear. There may be a lack of clarity in the rule, and that's the reason why we're trying to tease out the intersection between 486 and 426.
Well, the other thing I think we have to keep in context as we're talking about the intersection of 26 and 486 is how this case arose. I mean, this was a case that was fully prepared and ready to go to trial within a matter of days.
That's
when
correct.
Something changed with regard to one expert that trial counsel dealt with. And then suddenly this issue on November 10th results in plaintiff's counsel seeking the appointment of a guardian to change the entire track of this case toward an up and down on a richer settlement offer that materialized. So Justice Solomon is right to worry about where we go with the procedures in this case and its application in future cases, because what changed? This was a litigant that was ready with her counsel to go to trial. Counsel was ready to go to trial, and suddenly she becomes incompetent to make a decision over a particular settlement offer.
I can address that, Your Honor. Unfortunately, it would most likely require me to go a little bit beyond the record that's before the court.
Because we have Mr. Maselli's report, and the thing that they've mentioned before that
yes.
concerns me about it, which is really this is what went before the court, says he was giving her the opportunity to convince him that she was able to understand and could make an informed, rational, and reasoned decision regarding her case and her ability to understand it. So it seemed at that point the focus was on weighing the case against the settlement offer. And I'm not sure that that narrow an approach was appropriate, and I'm not sure that the way it was phrased placed the burden where it should have been.
Well, I'm not so certain, Your Honor, that for purposes of the guardian ad litem, whose duty is to conduct the investigation, that how the guardian, in this case it was a he, phrases his findings necessarily dictates to the court or sets the court up for looking at it from the standpoint of the burden of proof having been on ST. Certainly,
where were the experts that were before the court? I mean, this goes to the record that we don't really.
Right, the experts, the records that are before the court, of course, are Dr. Crane, who submitted the certification and had multiple litigation reports, and of course the records from Dr. Reed, and the records from the VA hospital, and records from the North Shore, the Long Island VA,
East Orange. That were prepared in anticipation of her going to trial, except for Dr. Crane.
No, Your Honor. If I may correct you, Dr. Crane's. And if I misunderstood your question, I apologize. Just so I'm clear, the records that were submitted were actually her treatment records from East Orange, from Long Island, and from the various sundry other of the scores of doctors that he saw. All of which, by the way,
all predated this application for a GAL, did they not?
They did. Their comments regarding ST's mental capacity in there, they speak for themselves. And they certainly support the notion that certainly trial counsel was correct in having those concerns.
But where is the
But maybe it would have supported an appointment of guardian from the get-go in this trial, but it doesn't support the changing of her being the litigant and making her own decisions to suddenly it being taken away from her when a settlement is on the table.
I can only do what your Honor can do, and that is read Mr. Connolly's certification, which of course is a matter of the record.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Connolly is a certified civil trial lawyer who's tried scores and scores and scores of cases, and I would think has a very good handle on whether he thinks that his client of many years is processing and understanding what he has to say.
Well, I'm sorry. Respond to Justice LeBecker.
No, Mr. Connolly is not a medical professional, Your Honor.
Thank you.
So that being the case, there still has to be at some point a judicial determination that a person doesn't have mental capacity. So, you know, the lawyer may have an opinion, the doctor may have an opinion, but there has to be a hearing in accordance with due process with a judicial finding, all of which is absent here, correct?
The lack of a hearing and a lack of a finding is absent here. That's correct, Your Honor.
And that is central to due process. Like the adversary, in this case, from ST's particular point, the guardian ad litem foisted on her against her will is her adversary. Okay, she doesn't want her adversary making the decision. She wants a judicial finding. Nothing wrong with that, is there?
No, but at the same time, Your Honor, again, at the friendly hearing, well, strike that. There was a friendly hearing. There was close judicial supervision of this entire process by Judge Carrick.
I've read the friendly hearing. In the friendly hearing, the judge is saying, you're really intelligent. I don't find that you're incompetent. I just think, he basically says, I think that this is a really fair offer.
Right.
And that it's wrong for you not to accept it. And she says in her, I wanted more money. And you're making the wrong decision. That's the friendly hearing is the judge is just making determination where this is a fair settlement. It has nothing to do with whether or not she should have a right to make the decision on her own.
Well,
with a standard of mental capacity.
At that stage, you're correct, Your Honor. But I think Your Honor should also be, as I'm sure Your Honor is, completely cognizant of the fact that during the question and answer period, ST was unable to answer simple questions put to her.
I did read it, and one might say that at points concerning her medical condition, she was rambling. But the one thing that came across clear to me is that she said, I've taken great chances in my life. Okay, I was one of the boat people who escaped from Vietnam. I took that chance, and I want to take a chance with this lawsuit. I know what chances are all about. I've taken them in my life, and you're taking it away from me. She makes that very clear, no?
She does, Your Honor, and if the court had, and if the attorneys had a reasonable belief that there wasn't clear and convincing evidence here that she was not competent to make that decision, Your Honor, I try cases all the time, and there's nothing more I'd like to do. If we had been sent back to a trial, we would have tried the case. Certainly, in this case, It would not have been fair for her to try this case and walk into the buzzsaw that she was going to walk into simply because, not because it was a bad decision, which I 100% believe would be a disaster for her to try this case. That's not the reason. It's because based on what Mr. Maselli had written and based on the court's questioning of the client in open court, that she did not understand what was going on around her in respect of what the pros and cons of her case were. If she didn't understand, as Mr. Connolly said, that, or Mr. Maselli said, that her chief expert on causation is refusing to testify, It sounds like almost a summary judgment motion to get the case dismissed. She didn't understand how it is that the people couldn't be compelled to appear to give opinion testimony.
It was actually a good question because she was a treating physician. She couldn't understand why her treating physician couldn't be brought to court. That's a pretty intelligent question.
Mr. Gradioso, as you answer that, bring your argument to a close, please.
Yeah. I guess everyone's had enough.
No, it's a little beyond 30 minutes. And
yeah, of course, Chief Justice, of course. I'll just address to the point that was raised was a while ago, so forgive me for not knowing which one of you said it, as I've answered a lot of questions, or attempted to answer a lot of questions.
If it was a good question, I apologize.
That's why I was looking right at you, Justice Solomon. If the court decides that this case should be remanded, what's the remedy? The remedy here should be a Rule 486 hearing. And if the court is going to develop in its order some type of protocol, some type of amendment to the rule, or some type of instruction to the law division to have that hearing, I'm hopeful that it would be at least in line with the concepts that were discussed in our papers. Good cause standard for the initial appointment, clear and convincing evidence after whatever policies or procedures should happen here. And if it turns out after that 486 hearing that ST is found to be competent to make this decision as opposed to any other decision, then I suppose there'll be a trial, which we'll deal with. If it's otherwise, I suppose it would be under Rule 486G, which is the more limited, scope. We would argue that the clear and convincing evidence standard should apply at that point.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Hansen. And you're welcome, of course, to adopt any arguments.
Chief Justice, members of the court, I've been told by judges never read the tea leaves, but I've sat through two arguments and I have a sense of what you're thinking. So I want to try to address some of the questions and correct what I perceive may be some misunderstandings on the part of the Chief and your fellow justices. First and foremost, the defendants did not bring this motion. In fact, the defendants were bystanders in the law division. But we come today not with respect to ST's competency, but rather to enforce the settlement. And I can say, not as a blind advocate for my client, but as a lawyer, as a person, I believe that justice was done in this case, so I want to address some of the other questions presented, and in particular, Justice Lavecchia, you commented this is scheduled for trial, the plaintiff didn't want like the offer, and all of a sudden it went in a different direction, and how can that be explained? Well, I have an explanation, and that is that this issue was ongoing for some time. Only Mr. Gaudioso was in this case from day one in terms of at least the lawyers in this courtroom today. I substituted in probably 2 years, 3 years into the litigation, so I was not present at the initial deposition of the plaintiff. But I did observe her on multiple occasions. And no, I am not a mental health professional, but as a layperson, you just knew something was wrong. I am a lawyer trained to read medical records, and that told me that something was wrong. And then the plaintiff got advice from someone and said, let me file this motion. And again, the defendants were bystanders to that application, but not surprised. Nor were we surprised by the result that Judge Carey, who was not trying to force a settlement, but rather was seeking justice. And that's what I'm trying to emphasize, getting away from the academics and talking about the intangibles. What was in the best interests of the plaintiff in this case? And I truly believe that that's what Judge Carey was trying to do. That's what the plaintiff's lawyer was trying to do with respect to the RPCs. And my concern is that, as the appellate division said, you put the cart before the horse and require a finding of incompetency before you undertake any of these procedures, then we're taking the RPC and ripping it up, throwing it out the window. But again, if I just a couple more minutes of your tolerance with me, because I want to now get to another question. Aren't litigants entitled to make bad mistakes? Well, yes, they make them all the time. I've gotten favorable verdicts, not because I'm a good lawyer, but because plaintiffs made bad mistakes. I've lost cases that should have been resolved, arguably, because of a bad decision on whether to resolve or not. Maybe my client would say bad lawyering. But lawyers render advice, and litigants often make mistakes. And they're entitled to make that mistake so long as they are competent to do so. And I hear the message and the questions from this court that there was no finding of competency. But again, you can't put the cart before the horse. The process has to begin somewhere. So Chief, you've asked all of the lawyers, Chief Justice Ravner, you've asked all of the lawyers, what is the standard that should be followed? And I say it's laid out perfectly in the opinion of the appellate division. It begins with 426.4, and now that we all look at it under the microscope, it's not clear. So the court improvised. And the first step is, per the rule itself, okay, is there good cause to appoint a guardian for a alleged mentally incompetent? An alleged mentally incompetent. And the commentary to the rule emphasizes that one need only be an alleged mentally incompetent. Now, granted, I understand that there may have been some due process problems in terms of what notice was provided. And as a defendant, we don't know. We don't know what you know in terms of what's been provided confidentially to the court. So to answer the question, that'll probably come to me, should there have been due process, should there have been notice, of course. But is that harmful error based on the facts of this case and how the case then proceeded? So that's the first step. What are the standards? The first standard is follow Rule 426 in terms of the appointment of a guardian ad litem for the litigation, okay, based on an alleged mental incompetency. The allegation of mental incompetency, I agree, does not by itself permit the GAL to take over, does not permit the GAL to strip the plaintiff of the decision to settle or not, or strip a defendant of the decision to settle or not. So as articulated so well by the appellate division, there is a second step in this process. And that was the September order by which Judge Carey empowered the GAL to make the decision. And the question then is, well, is there a need for a incompetency hearing before that occurs? Well, the rules of professional conduct don't require it. Rule 426 doesn't require it. The comment leaves to the discretion of the GAL whether a competency hearing should be recommended. So as this court many, many years ago said of its trial judges, they're made of stern stuff. And there needs to be some delegation to the law division, to the judge in the pits, whether in this case there was competency. And I agree, there is no order that memorializes that the law division declared this plaintiff to be incompetent For what? For purposes of intelligently making decisions with respect to the litigation. And that's the distinction between 426 and 486. And we're only talking about 426. So having said that, that decision was made. That decision was made by the order empowering the GAL. That decision was made based upon all of the medical records. And a question was asked, is the plaintiff competent? Is she able to live on her own? Well, just last night, going through the medical records, I'm reading and I'm trying to find it at a counsel table, and I can't find the reference, but where the plaintiff is saying that she takes a shower and she forgets that she leaves shampoo in her hair, that her utilities have been turned off because she forgets to pay her bills, that she turns the teapot on and the kitchen smokes up because there's no water in the pot, and on and on and on. So there are multiple examples, and obviously it's not for this court at this point on de novo review to determine whether there was competency or
but
not.
See, what you're pointing at is are the damages that the plaintiff is alleging as a result of the injury. Forgetfulness is different from whether or not you have the capacity to make basic determinations about the affairs of your life. Now, you said that the order that the judge, did the judge basically delegate to the guardian ad litem decision whether or not ST was mentally incapacitated without making that decision on his own?
What, and I don't mean to be cute, certainly, with you, but engage in semantics, but at some point there's form or substance. No, from a form perspective, there was no memorialization of a declaration of mental incompetency. But implicit in the empowering of the GAL to make decisions on behalf of the plaintiff for purposes of the litigation was a finding by the trial judge based on the lengthy record of mental incompetency.
Even if that were the case, wouldn't ST have a right to a hearing the way any alleged mentally incapacitated person would have a right to a hearing under 486. They have a right even to a, there are circumstances where an alleged mentally incompetent person would even have a right to a jury trial under the rule.
In the ideal world, yes, which would require a rewrite of the rule. Based on the rule as it existed, that hearing was not required because there was no recommendation from the GAL, who had been empowered based upon a lengthy analysis of the medical records and the confidential certifications of both the GAL and the prior attorney of record.
Don't we at least have the right to have from the trial court what he based his decision to empower the guardian upon? Upon what did he base his opinion or order to empower the guardian? Don't we have a right to at least know that, which we don't even know? There's a lot of stuff in the record, but we don't know how he came to this conclusion you're saying he came to.
I would lose credibility with this court if I didn't agree with such a question, a softball that calls for me to say, yes, of course, in the best of worlds. But that concept needs to be weighed against the remedy. The remedy, and I'm jumping now, but in terms of the standard, follow the appellate division three-step process. You know, what is the remedy if we go back? Is it an incompetency hearing? Well, do the defendants have standing to try to declare a plaintiff incompetent? I think no. We're here to enforce a settlement, and I'll get back to that. What are the roles going forward? This all arose out of an RPC where an attorney put his name on a certification that was submitted to the court saying my client has diminished capacity. And I truly believe that's what happened. This was not an effort by a team of lawyers in the court to get a settlement forced down on the plaintiff.
Look, no one's suggesting that the attorney was not acting professionally. He may have thought that his client had diminished capacity, or even requesting the appointment of the guardian ad litem to conduct an investigation. It's everything afterwards. There's no hearing. There's no notice. Justice Solomon was saying, there's no statement of reasons for the decision. That's one of the most basic things under our court rules. A determination has to be followed by a statement of reasons. Why did the court make the decision it made?
I was not being articulate because I understand your point, so let me try again. We go back on the remedy. What are the roles? Who fulfills the role on a remand on a competency hearing per 486 to declare that the plaintiff is incompetent? I heard Mr. Dawkins say they don't want a competency hearing. They want to go right to trial. So who plays that? The prior attorney is long gone. Who pays for the doctors? Who has the burden of proof? Who has the interest? This all arose out of an RPC, out of an attorney's concern, out of a member of the bar's concern that ST had diminished capacity.
Well,
so
the court,
now we're going to...
Under the court rule, first of all, if Mr. Dawkins remains as the attorney, he can initiate it. A member of the family can initiate it or not initiate it. Or the court on its own motion can do it. It's under the rule. The court on its own motion can set the wheels in motion, yes?
And I guess my point is, who's the lawyer that presents the evidence? Who's the lawyer that calls the doctors? Who's the lawyer that advocates not competency but incompetency?
And
it's not going to be Mr. Dawkins.
And add to your list one other question. What are the consequences if the standard is broader than assessing competency for purposes of deciding this case? And here's a concern. A litigant walks into the courtroom, files a lawsuit, and says, I'm entitled to relief in connection with this injury. Are we setting in motion a proceeding where before we get to the end of the case, there have now been determinations made that could have long-lasting consequences well beyond the case if we apply a broader standard, such that there are now findings that would justify the appointment of a guardian to manage broad areas of that person's life? Should that be considered as we assess what to do in the context of a personal injury suit with bystanders and a plaintiff and finding the right standard for that case to be resolved?
It is indeed a concern, and I submit that the appellate division opinion answers that concern by the three-part process. The fact that a litigant doesn't want to rationally decide when to cut the losses and try to resolve the case or not hire experts or even walk away, that's not a basis. I agree. There has to be some evidence. And Justice, I'm not a mental health professional nor an advocate, but sometimes you know that you have to go to one. And if there is evidence, objective evidence from those professionals that is presented to the court for good cause, that begins the process. And so while the process may need to be rearticulated by an amendment to the rules, the appellate division got it right. I mean, I'm not clever enough or smart enough to come up with any argument any better than what the appellate division
laid out.
Well,
the rule is partly here. I mean, you could actually read into it. Or if the court has concerns that the person's allegedly mentally incapacitated, he can appoint a guardian ad litem who then would collect the evidence, medical, make a recommendation to the court, but then there would have to be a hearing with notice to ST, and then possible testimony and findings of fact by the court. Yes? Wouldn't that be the process?
It's certainly as good a solution as I can answer standing on my feet right now.
Anything else you'd like to add?
Yes, and this is important. If this case is remanded, I should not be part of the remand process. There was a cross appeal before the appellate division. The appellate division in its last paragraph said we're not going to address the cross appeal because we're affirming the settlement. I had my client Idesco had on appeal a motion for a order denying a motion for summary judgment on the statute of limitations. The issue is very straightforward. More than 2 years after the complaint was filed, my colleague president of counsel table filed a third party complaint against my client. Subsequent thereto, the plaintiff filed a motion to elevate my client as a direct defendant. We filed a motion seeking dismissal of the direct complaint based on the statute of limitations. Plaintiff defended based upon the fictitious practice rule. However, the plaintiff acknowledged that no due diligence was ever taken to identify my client. And I know it's late, but just a minute to provide the facts.
Can I ask you a question? And you're welcome to give us the facts and your response. Ordinarily, if the active doesn't reach an issue, and we reverse on the question that they did determine, the matter is remanded to the active for the unresolved issue. Why wouldn't that make sense here?
We, in my submission to this court, we provided that as a remedy to address this specific issue.
You don't want the issue to be overlooked.
Got it. Thank you. Thank you to all counsel. We're going to take a brief recess and be back for Kornbluth versus Westover in a few moments.